Hello and welcome back to The Deep Dive. I am Alex Vanderbilt, and joining me, as always, is the person who synthesizes the signal from the noise, Sam Astor.
It's good to be here. We have a mountain of source material today, all stemming from one central publication.
We certainly do. We are dedicating this entire deep dive to unpacking the most critical events, conflicts, and decisions of the day, as reported in the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, December 11th, 2025.
And our mission today is pretty straightforward. We're going to give you, the listener, a really comprehensive, highly detailed look at everything that's moving the needle.
Exactly. From the contested decisions driving the global economy to the high-stakes financial deals shaping corporate life and some truly audacious actions reshaping geopolitics.
So let's jump right in.
Lex, we're starting at the very core of the financial world with a moment of extreme tension and really deep internal division at the Federal Reserve. And this has huge implications for your borrowing costs and, you know, the job market.
That's absolutely right. When the Fed makes a policy decision, it's rarely just about that quarter point change. It's really about the internal calculus, the forecasting, and, you know, the ideology that drives that final vote.
And this one was particularly fraught.
It was. It came amid these sharp macroeconomic cross currents that really reveal a deep, deep disagreement on where the U.S. economy is actually headed.
Okay, let's unpack this. A monumental decision. The Federal Reserve, meeting this week, delivered its third straight interest rate cut.
That's right.
They reduced the benchmark federal funds rate by a quarter point, setting the new range at 3.5 to 3.75%. That officially puts rates at a three-year low. This was basically a preemptive move, right?
It was sold as an insurance cut. That's a very specific and targeted policy choice. The sources detail the stated goal is strictly defensive.
Defensive how?
Well, the Fed is trying to protect the economy against a sharper-than-anticipated slowdown in hiring that they fear is looming on the horizon. And Chair Jerome Powell was really keen to manage expectations. He signaled that this might be the end of the easing cycle for a while, saying they are, quote, well-positioned to wait and see how the economy evolves from here.
But the decision itself was anything but unanimous or comfortable?
Not even close.
And that comfort level, or lack thereof, is where the story gets really, really interesting. We're looking at a highly unusual 9-3 split vote.
Which you just don't see very often.
It's the first time in 6 years that three officials have dissented from a Fed decision. That just screams a deeply fractured committee. I mean, maybe more so than we've seen in a generation.
It's a profound ideological tension. It's like a microcosm of the entire U.S. economic debate playing out right there, inside the walls of the Federal Reserve.
So who are the dissenters?
He had two officials, Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee and Kansas City Fed President Jeff Schmid, who outright opposed the cut. The hawks. Their stance is driven by this conviction that the economy is stronger than the data suggests, and crucially, that rates aren't high enough yet to definitively tame inflation, which, you know, has been stubbornly above that 2% target since 2021.
So for them, cutting now just risks reigniting the fire.
Exactly. It risks undoing years of effort. But then you had a dissent from the complete opposite direction, which is, I think, even more telling about the uncertainty here.
Right.
Governor Stephen Miron dissented because he favored a larger half-point reduction.
You wanted to go bigger.
Much bigger. Miron's dovish view is based on the idea that the risks are asymmetric. You know, if inflation lingers at 3%, that's bad, but it's manageable. But if the labor market suddenly craters, well, they would need massive aggressive intervention to fix it.
So he's looking at the cooling data and saying, we need to get ahead of this.
We haven't done enough yet. We need to get ahead of a potential recession.
So they are grappling with firm price pressures on one side and a cooling labor market on the other. It feels like a very uncomfortable dilemma. Why is this policy trade-off so difficult right now?
Because it recalls the ghost of 1970s stagflation.
Right. High inflation, slow growth.
And high unemployment. Now, we are nowhere near 1970s inflation levels, but just the possibility that high prices and a shrinking job market could coincide, that is the core anxiety. The inflation-wary hawks worry the economy is stronger than it looks. The employment-focused doves, backed by Powell, argue the job market needs these insurance cuts.
And the most shocking piece of information Powell presented, which truly underpinned the decision of those doves, was his warning about potentially overstated job creation figures.
This was the bombshell.
He essentially told the market that the labor numbers we've all been relying on are likely fiction.
And this is where the deep dive gets really important for the average person relying on those unemployment statistics. Fed staff estimate that the federal data may be overestimating job creation by up to 60,000 positions.
60,000 a month.
Per month. Now, put that into context. The published data shows the U.S. economy has added only about 40,000 jobs a month since April.
The implication there is just, it's stark.
It is. The real job growth since April, according to the Fed's own internal estimation, may actually be negative 20,000 jobs a month.
Wow.
That concern that the job market is actually shedding jobs, not gaining them, was central to justifying the rate cut, even though on the surface, unemployment is still only 4.4%. It's a huge policy pivot based on skepticism of their own government's statistics.
So let's go a layer deeper on why this error is happening. What's the mechanism the government is missing?
It all boils down to a technical element known as the Labor Department's birth-death model.
Okay, the birth-death model.
Right. It's a statistical model they use because, you know, it's impossible for the government to survey every single brand new startup or every small company that closes its doors immediately, so they have to guess. They estimate the jobs created and destroyed by new and closed businesses.
And the problem is?
The problem is that in economic slowdowns, this model is really slow to register small business closures. And historically, especially in recent years, this technique has systematically overstated job creation by hundreds of thousands annually, which leads to these painful downward revisions months or even years later.
So Powell's basically saying they can't afford to wait for that data.
He's saying they have to act on the assumption that the labor market is already under pressure.
And Wall Street, despite all these nuanced concerns, they just responded with, what, enthusiasm? They heard rate cut and Powell's dovish tone, and they cheered.
The market was already anticipating the quarter point cut, but that commentary, especially the clear signal that the Fed is prioritizing employment risks, that helped fuel a major rally.
How major?
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 497 points. That's its best performance on a Fed decision day since 2023. The S&P 500 rose 0.7%, NASDAQ up 0.3%. And what's most interesting is the Russell 2000 index, you know, the smaller companies, that closed at a record high.
Which usually signaled some real optimism about the domestic economy.
Robust optimism, exactly.
That sounds like great news, but let's bring it back to the listener. If I'm trying to buy a house or buy a new car, does this enthusiasm immediately translate into savings for me?
Not immediately. And this is the crucial disconnect. The Fed's moves, they primarily influence short-term borrowing costs.
So credit cards, auto loans.
Things like that. Longer-term interest rates, which affect 30-year mortgages and large business investment loans, they've seen far more modest declines since the cuts began. The 10-year Treasury yield, which is what dictates mortgage rates, it closed the day at 4.163%.
So not a huge drop.
Not enough to provide significant relief for would-be homebuyers who are still grappling with historically high mortgage payments. So, you know, market euphoria doesn't equal easy borrowing for consumers just yet.
Okay, before we pivot away from the Fed, we have to address a lesser known but potentially profound decision they made, resuming balance sheet expansion.
Yes.
Some are calling this the start of Q-ternity.
And it is a huge, subtle shift that confirms a long-term change in our financial architecture. The Fed decided to resume balance sheet expansion by buying $40 billion of short-term Treasury securities this month.
Reversing a three-year contraction effort. That's an about-face.
A complete about-face. And they're doing this in direct response to recent volatility and elevated borrowing costs in the repo market.
The repo market. Can you just quickly break that down for us?
Of course. The repo market is basically where banks and financial institutions lend and borrow cash overnight, using Treasury securities as collateral. It's the plumbing of the financial system.
And when that plumbing gets clogged,
it can cause wider instability. So the Fed's purchase of $40 billion in short-term treasuries is meant to inject liquidity and smooth out those specific borrowing costs.
So it's not quantitative easing in the traditional sense, but it is a massive intervention.
Precisely. The Fed insists this is just a technical adjustment. But the implication, and this is why some call it Q-ternity, is that the central bank's post-2008 framework likely requires it to be a net purchaser of treasuries, essentially forever.
So what was supposed to be temporary is now permanent.
It's looking like a permanent feature of the U.S. financial landscape.
Yeah.
The Fed is here to stay as a primary active market participant.
That idea of permanent intervention is a colossal consideration, and it provides a smooth thematic bridge as we pivot now from domestic finance to global conflict, because the scale of the financial commitment being discussed for Ukraine's future is just staggering.
It is, and it's creating huge rifts between the U.S. and its European allies. The war in Ukraine has really evolved from being primarily a ground conflict to this intense, high-stakes negotiating battle over reconstruction, peace terms, and crucially, the future economic relationship with Russia.
And here's where we see the distinct, and I think you could say controversial, vision of the current U.S. administration laid out. The U.S. presented its European counterparts with documents detailing what's been dubbed the Trump blueprint for Ukraine's post-war funding.
And this plan centers on using roughly $200 billion of frozen Russian assets, the vast majority of which are held in European financial institutions, to fund U.S. financial firms and businesses for massive reconstruction projects in Ukraine.
So this isn't just about handing over cash. It's about establishing an American economic foothold.
A major one. The U.S. vision includes these massive, specific infrastructure projects, like building a colossal new data center in Ukraine.
A data center.
A huge one. And this data center would be powered by the currently Russian-occupied Zaporizhia nuclear plant once it's secured. The sheer audacity of planning future infrastructure around a currently occupied nuclear facility. It gives you a sense of the ambition here.
But the part that is generating the most friction, the most skepticism in Europe, involves the U.S.'s broader vision for Russia itself.
This is the lightning rod.
The idea of bringing Russia's economy in from the cold.
This is what's causing the real trouble. The U.S. plan involves offering Russia an economic on-ramp via U.S. investment in strategic Russian sectors. We're talking about Arctic oil, rare earth extraction, and even restoring energy flows to Western Europe.
Which is unthinkable for the Europeans.
Unthinkable. They spent years painstakingly weaning themselves off Russian gas since the 2022 invasion to starve the Kremlin's war machine. And now this.
The critique from European officials was brutal. One compared the plan to the 1945 conference that divided Europe. Why such a harsh parallel?
The fear is one of strategic betrayal and a huge economic imbalance. European officials fear the plan offers Russia an economic reprieve that would let them refuel their long-term economy, stabilize their currency, and become militarily stronger just years after the conflict ends.
So it's like rewarding them.
It's like giving the bear a massive new food supply instead of letting it starve. That's how they see it.
And Europe has a counterproposal, which is far more focused on Kyiv's immediate survival.
Their plan is much more direct. It's focused on core budgetary needs. They want to lend Ukraine about half of those $200 billion in frozen assets over the next 2 years to support Kyiv's government and its military. And this financial lifeline is absolutely critical.
Because Europe is now footing most of the bill.
Exactly. Following the Trump administration's pullback of aid, Europe is now covering the majority of Ukraine's ongoing war efforts. But even their plan is stalled.
Why is that?
It's held up largely due to opposition from Belgium, which is where the bulk of the deposits are held. Belgian officials fear legal retribution. They fear the systemic risk of confiscating sovereign assets. It could set a dangerous precedent.
The complexities of that financial conflict really contrast sharply with the sheer human audacity we see in the military conflict, which brings us to this unbelievable covert operation, Ukraine's Operation Spiderweb.
This is truly a story ripped from a spy thriller.
Yeah.
It gives us the first detailed account of a mission executed by Ukraine's security service, the SBU.
The problem was simple. Russia was bombarding Ukrainian cities with massive bomber fleets.
Right, from airfields deep inside Russia, far beyond the range of Ukraine's air defenses. So President Zelensky gave the SBU a direct order.
Mm-hmm.
Hit those planes on the ground.
And their solution was a modern twist on the Trojan horse.
A brilliant one. Necessity drove invention. The SBU needed to deliver 117 custom-built drones deep into enemy territory without being detected. So their planners settled on this idea of smuggling them inside eight massive prefabricated cabins.
Cabins on trucks.
These cabins were the size of shipping containers loaded onto trucks driven by unwitting Russian civilian drivers. And they had these custom-designed roofs that were supposed to slide open remotely to act as drone launch pads.
The logistics of organizing that across 2,000 miles of enemy territory just sounds insane.
It was meticulously planned over 18 months. They used a Ukrainian-born coordinator, a man named Artem Timofeyev, who had lived in Russia for years, to rent a warehouse deep inside the country. His job was to hire drivers and coordinate the movement.
And the drones themselves are special.
It's bespoke. Dinner plate-sized quadcopters carrying 4 pounds of specialized explosives. And this payload was tailored specifically to penetrate aircraft armor and ignite the fuel tanks of those massive bombers.
And we learned the operation nearly fell apart before it even began.
That near disaster is pure drama. About 180 miles into a 2,000-mile drive, one of the drivers panicked. The roof of his cabin slid off, exposing the illicit drone cargo. He called Timofeyev in a frenzy.
So what did they do?
The SBU planners in Kyiv had to quickly invent a plausible cover story. They told the coordinator to assure the driver the cabins were hunting lodges and the drones were for tracking animals.
And he bought it.
Incredibly, the driver bought it, fixed the roof, and kept driving. Operation Spiderweb was back on.
What was the final result of that mission?
It was devastatingly successful. 117 quadcopters launched simultaneously from four trucks near four massive Russian airfields.
Yeah.
For the Ukrainian drone pilots controlling the attack from Kyiv, the defenseless Russian warplanes, including two 22 M3 supersonic bombers, were, and I'm quoting here, like fish in a barrel.
So what's the official damage count?
Ukraine claims 41 Russian planes were struck or damaged, with at least a dozen deemed irreparable. The operation achieved the strategic goal, and it served as this massive morale boost for the SBU.
A staggering demonstration of ingenuity under pressure. From the war zones of Ukraine, let's turn to another active pressure point in global power politics, Venezuela, where the crisis continues to escalate.
And it's tied directly to U.S. pressure. We have two simultaneous events here that really underscore just how volatile the situation with the Maduro regime is. The first is the dramatic, almost unbelievable, escape of opposition leader Maria Corina Machado.
She had won the popular vote, but was barred from taking office and had been in hiding for a year.
Right. And she was fleeing to Norway to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. This was no simple flight. It was a clandestine exit, a perilous 10-hour journey just to reach the coast, navigating 10 military checkpoints.
And then taking a small skiff across the Caribbean.
A small wooden fishing skiff across choppy seas to the island of Curaçao. And here is the subtle but vital connection to the U.S. security apparatus, the group undertaking the escape. They made a life-saving decision.
What was that?
They warned the U.S. military of the skiff's occupant. This was essential to avoid the kind of accidental airstrike that has recently killed more than 80 people on similar vessels in that region.
And then she was met in Curaçao.
She was met by a private contractor supplied by the Trump administration before flying safely to Oslo.
And coinciding with that high-profile escape, the U.S. significantly escalated financial pressure on Maduro by seizing a major oil tanker.
Correct. The U.S. seized a massive oil tanker, identified as the Skipper, formerly the Edisa, off the coast of Venezuela. Attorney General Pam Bondi confirmed the tanker had been sanctioned.
For what, exactly?
For transporting illicit oil-supporting terrorist organizations. It was carrying about 1.1 million barrels of crude, covertly loaded from both Venezuela and Iran. This is a direct financial blow, confirmed by President Trump, who assumed the U.S. would keep the oil.
These global tensions really highlight the central role technology plays in both conflict and commerce. Let's bring it back now to the race to control the future. Specifically, artificial intelligence, where the battle is literally extending into space.
Yeah, when we talk about AI dominance, we generally focus on chip fabrication and these massive terrestrial data centers. But now, the major players, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, are competing to move that trillion-dollar data center boon into orbit.
The ultimate battle of the billionaires. And the rationale is compelling. They want to avoid massive earthly headaches.
Especially securing the immense and growing power needed for training gigantic AI models. Instead, you can utilize the immense solar power available in orbit without the constraints of a local power grid.
And both have serious plans.
Very serious. SpaceX intends to use upgraded Starlink satellites to host AI computing payloads. Blue Origin has established a dedicated team focused entirely on orbital AI data center technology.
But the hurdles are severe. This isn't just launching a rack of servers into space. What are the specific technical challenges here?
Oh, the challenges are immense. Thermal management is maybe the biggest. How do you dissipate the massive heat generated by thousands of GPUs in a vacuum? Then there's radiation, which constantly degrades components. And finally, data transfer. You have to get the data back to Earth without a debilitating lag time.
The scale of it is hard to imagine.
A Google executive working on this estimated it would take 10,000 satellites to recreate the capacity of a single 1 gigawatt terrestrial data center.
Huh?
So the cost and reliability of launch remain the core obstacle.
And the idea of putting national AI infrastructure outside a territorial control, that raises profound geopolitical questions. But let's bring the focus back down to Earth. There's this enduring paradox of U.S.-China tech relations. Despite Congress trying to limit American investment, U.S. capital is still flowing heavily into Chinese AI.
That tension is undeniable. Contextually, the House just passed the annual defense spending bill, which grants President Trump new authority to strengthen existing Biden-era limits on U.S. investment in high-tech Chinese industries like AI.
So the message from Washington is clear.
House leadership is very clear. Investments propping up communist China's aggression must come to an end.
Yet, capital is blind to geopolitics. It's just chasing returns.
That's exactly the dynamic. Public market investors are drawn by the simple fact that Chinese AI models, notably led by a company called DeepSeek, have become genuinely competitive with their U.S. peers this year.
And that translates to stock performance.
Directly. Funds managed by major U.S. firms like Vanguard, BlackRock, and Fidelity have actively increased their stakes in companies like Alibaba, whose shares are up more than 80% this year. Tencent and Baidu are up nearly 50%. The driver is opportunity.
That economic tension, the reliance on China for growth, it highlights a core vulnerability, which brings us directly to the issue of critical minerals. For all the talk of high-tech dominance, America remains reliant on China for the very materials needed to build the future.
China dominates the entire supply chain, from high-risk, low-margin mining to the final processing of minerals vital for everything from F-35 jets to satellites to high-capacity batteries.
And past U.S. efforts to build a domestic supply chain have fizzled out?
They have, because whenever the U.S. started building capacity, China deliberately flooded the market with cheap supply, tanking prices, and making American operations uneconomical.
So the solution can't just be more traditional mining. It has to be fundamentally innovative and cost-effective to survive China's pricing tactics.
That's the consensus among U.S. startups in this case. One compelling example is a company called Brimstone, based in Oakland. They are pioneering a solution using proprietary chemistry to extract critical minerals like aluminum and magnesium from abundant, inexpensive gabbro rock.
The same rock used for roads.
The very same. Their goal is radical, to achieve 40% lower costs than traditional mineral processing methods. That cost advantage is really the only way to build a resilient, independent domestic supply chain.
And AI is playing a role here too.
Yes. AI is being used to improve mining exploration success rates and even create new metal alloys that mimic the properties of scarce minerals. As the CEO of Brimstone said, success requires creating a process that is lower cost and higher profit from the start.
Speaking of profit and finance, let's look at the financial architecture enabling massive corporate deals. We are seeing the definitive return of debt-powered takeovers.
You've seen a record dollar amount this year for big-ticket M&A, specifically those deals valued at $10 billion or more. And this surge is powered by a renewed, almost aggressive appetite for debt among major banks and the booming private credit funds.
But these debt-heavy deals transfer a lot of risk.
A huge amount of risk, directly onto bond investors.
The ongoing, highly dramatic, hostile bid for Warner Bros. Discovery, the Paramount WBD saga, is the perfect case study here.
It truly encapsulates the current environment. You have two massive debt-laden offers on the table. Paramount's hostile bid included a staggering $54 billion in committed debt financing.
And Netflix's.
Their proposal features an even larger commitment of $59 billion in debt. And the market immediately reacted. Warner Bros. Discovery bond prices dropped about 5% in December, largely because the Paramount bid was more debt-heavy than analysts had expected.
So you have two bidders trying to finance a $100 billion-plus empire with over $100 billion in potential total debt, yet the stock is trading high.
It is. The fact that Warner's stock is trading near the offer price suggests investors are highly confident that a higher bid featuring even more debt is coming. Wall Street is betting the deal machine will keep humming, powered by ready financing and, you know, the expectation of a regulatory environment under the Trump administration that will be highly accommodating to large mergers.
That expectation of regulatory accommodation brings us back full circle to U.S.-China technology policy, specifically NVIDIA, where we saw a powerful opinion piece critiquing a recent presidential decision on AI chips.
Yes, a strong pointed critique of President Trump's decision to allow NVIDIA to sell its advanced H200 chips to China.
And what was the deal structure?
In exchange for permission to sell, the U.S. Treasury would receive a 25% cut of those massive sales. The core argument of the opinion piece is that this decision trades away a critical, long-term U.S. technological and national security advantage computing power for what amounts to pennies on the dollar.
And the strategic importance of that H200 chip is undisputed. The Justice Department recently unveiled charges for smuggling these exact chips.
That just underscores their status as the ultimate dual-use technology. These chips are essential for advancing generative AI models for both civilian applications and potentially for military research. The critique argues that allowing this sale simply gives Chinese companies like DeepSeek the exact tool they need to close the 18 to 24-month gap they currently have with U.S. leaders like Google and OpenAI.
It's essentially subsidizing their technological catch-up.
That's the argument. And it creates domestic friction, too, because American AI developers are already facing a severe compute shortage themselves. Instead of prioritizing those chips for domestic developers, the administration shows a short-term financial win for the Treasury.
A fascinating example of policy contradiction. Shifting gears now, let's look at some major transformations occurring within the world of business and media specifically. The palpable upheaval underway at CBS News.
The venerable institution of CBS News is undergoing a profound structural shakeup under new leadership. Editor-in-Chief Barry Weiss and Paramount CEO David Ellison. This transformation signals a clear intent to move away from the current status quo.
And the most visible sign of this shift is the major anchor change at the evening news desk. Tony DeCupel has been named the new anchor of CBS Evening News.
DeCupel's elevation is significant because it directly aligns with Weiss's stated mission to deliver an approach that Americans hungry for fairness will see night after night.
And he himself was at the center of a debate over the network's tone recently.
He was. He made controversial comments regarding a book critical of Israel, which prompted a serious internal meeting about bias and objectivity. The fact that he was elevated really underscores Weiss and Ellison's push to intentionally refocus the network's identity and tone.
Speaking of media changes, YouTube TV, which has done a fantastic job replicating the traditional cable bundle, is now trying to break it apart with skinny bundles.
Yes, YouTube TV, which now boasts roughly 10 million subscribers, is introducing a slate of genre-specific channel packages in early 2026. This is the direct answer to consumer demand for more flexibility.
So instead of being stuck with the $83 base plan, I can now just pay for what I want.
That's the strategy. They'll offer options like a dedicated sports plan with ESPN, FS1, NBC Sports Network, but at a lower cost than the base subscription. The hope is that by allowing consumers to pick only the content they're willing to pay for, they can win new customers.
Now let's talk corporate finance, where a clear winner in the AI race, Oracle, is facing massive investor anxiety despite securing colossal contracts.
Oracle's recent financial report narrowly missed analyst expectations. And that, combined with a major hike in capital spending forecasts, led to significant investor unease.
How big a hike?
Oracle raised its capital expenditure forecast by a massive and somewhat shocking $15 billion for the current fiscal year. This instantly fueled concerns about the timeline for actually turning this immense AI demand into tangible profit.
But the demand is undeniable. The contract commitments are huge.
They are. Oracle announced massive new contract bookings from Meta, NVIDIA, and others, causing their backlog of deals to surge to $523 billion. That famously includes OpenAI's commitment to purchase $300 billion in computing power.
So why the anxiety? Why did the stock drop 11%?
Because the cash outlay is immediate, and the revenue realization is years away. Oracle CFO stated they don't expect the $4 billion of additional revenue from these recent bookings until fiscal 2027. So the market is facing this brutal short-term trade-off, immense future demand, but mounting near-term costs.
Let's shift to the automotive world. Japan's number three car maker, Nissan, is trying to engineer a massive turnaround in the U.S. market after what's really been a lost decade.
They have struggled immensely. U.S. sales have fallen 40% over the past decade. The U.S. boss, Christian Meunier, who returned to Nissan after a successful stint running Jeep, openly admitted the company was lost, lacking a coherent vision.
And he's implementing some drastic fixes to reignite that fighting spirit.
Multi-pronged fixes. First, he ordered corporate employees back to the office 4 days a week. Second, he's focusing on fixing chronic underutilization at its two U.S. factories. And third, and most critically, they're addressing their severe lack of hybrid technology, which has left them far behind rivals like Toyota.
So what's the hybrid plan?
They're accelerating it, starting with the Rogue crossover next year. He also plans to potentially bring back the rugged Xterra SUV, which he sees as the perfect combination of what Nissan is about.
Finally, a quick note on leadership stability at Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola announced that CEO James Quincey will step down in March. He'll be replaced by the chief operating officer, Henrik Braun. This maintains a familiar and stable internal succession path for the beverage giant.
A quick and clean transition. Unlike the choppy, politically charged waters of U.S. domestic policy, where we're seeing a remarkable split in the GOP regarding healthcare.
This is a major test of Republican unity. a growing faction of the party is openly breaking with leadership over Affordable Care Act subsidies. These subsidies are set to lapse next year, which would trigger big, highly visible cost increases for millions of households.
And the rationale for the break is just pragmatic politics ahead of the 2026 midterms.
Exactly. Avert widespread public pain. Buy time for a bigger overhaul down the road. The logjam is the House leadership. Speaker Mike Johnson opposes extending the subsidies,
which has led centrists to try and force a vote.
Right, using a discharge petition to circumvent Johnson. The plan calls for a 2-year extension coupled with fraud crackdowns and income limits. The willingness of even conservative Republicans to seek a temporary extension just shows you the political reality of that impending cliff.
Transitioning to the judiciary, we have a significant ruling blocking a federal deployment of the National Guard in California.
That's right. Federal Judge Charles Breyer in San Francisco ordered the Trump administration to end the deployment of the California National Guard in Los Angeles, citing ongoing calm in the city.
And the judge's commentary carried some strong political weight.
It was direct and constitutional. The ruling quoted Breyer's core, finding that the president is not king and cannot federalize the National Guard whenever he chooses without proper justification.
From the National Guard to national aesthetics, the Trump administration also made an unexpected decision regarding proposed coin designs for the 250th anniversary in 2026.
The administration jettisoned a previously proposed special series of 2026 quarters, the ones that would have honored abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, and the civil rights movement. So figures like Frederick Douglass and Ruby Bridges are out.
And what are the replacements?
The new designs feature images inspired by the Mayflower Compact, the Revolutionary War, and the Gettysburg Address. They'll feature Presidents Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Madison. This shift clearly reflects the administration's stated aesthetic vision, focusing intensely on classical architecture and traditional symbols.
We've covered political splits and aesthetic choices, but let's end this policy section on a regulatory matter that speaks directly to the politicization of finance. The debanking probe.
This is a massive finding from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, a top banking regulator. They announced preliminary findings from an investigation into 9 of the biggest U.S. banks, including giants like JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America.
And what did they find?
They found early evidence that these banks may have improperly refused to do business with a range of politically hot-button industries, specifically citing oil and gas companies and firearms manufacturers.
So the government is essentially saying banks are being too political in who they lend to.
That's the core argument. The report takes aim in particular at environmental, social, and governance ESG-related decisions the banks made in prior years. The comptroller, a Trump appointee, directly stated it was unfortunate that the nation's largest banks thought these harmful debanking policies were an appropriate use of their government-granted charter.
A huge finding that could reshape how banks interact with controversial industries. Now, let's turn our attention to the human element, examining social trends, corporate life, and some surprising community efforts.
And we'll start with a fascinating piece of research that highlights the overlooked toll of data breaches, the emotional and psychological cost that far exceeds the financial damage we usually focus on.
We hear constantly about credit monitoring, but this research suggests the real damage is internal. A survey of Australian victims showed that while 29% reported financial loss, a staggering 50% reported emotional harm.
And nearly a third reported a direct impact on their physical well-being. And what's driving this is the exposure of incredibly sensitive digital information, health data, private images, dating profiles. That exposure creates constant debilitating uncertainty and anxiety.
So the implication is we need a new response model for breaches.
Absolutely. The research suggests victims should be offered counseling and psychological support similar to what's offered for victims of other personal crimes. It's an acknowledgement that data breaches create real, verifiable psychological trauma.
Speaking of human interaction, the hybrid workplace has thrown a wrench into long-established business etiquette.
It really has, necessitating a refresh of the rulebook. The recently updated guide based on Emily Post's business etiquette tackles these modern dilemmas.
Okay, let's start with the big one, the Zoom camera, on or off?
The guide says the camera should be on, even if the organizer doesn't require it. It's considered a fundamental courtesy.
What about taking calls in an open plan office? We've all been there.
The guide is clear. If you are in an open plan office, the polite thing to do is find a private area. The onus shouldn't be on your colleagues to wear headphones all day to cope with your noise.
And the awkwardness of scheduling a meeting.
Right. The guide recommends you should send availability options. three dates and times. Instead of immediately sending a Calendly link, sending the link first is considered presumptuous.
Finally, the delicate topics, handshakes and body odor.
The handshake rule is pragmatic. If someone extends their hand after you just saw them cough into it, the rule is to shake their hand, then excuse yourself to wash your hands as soon as you can.
And body odor.
The best response is to find a discreet, private way to tell the person about the problem directly, viewing it as constructive criticism meant to help them.
Now let's talk sports. Major League Baseball, where the Detroit Tigers are facing a painful dilemma that exposes the league's core financial flaw.
The Tigers are a good team, but the sources confirm they are seriously considering trading away their absolute star, pitcher Tarik Skubal, who has won the last two American League Cy Young Awards.
Why on earth would you trade the best young pitcher in baseball?
Cold, hard economics. MLB is the only major North American sports league without a salary cap. Skubal is set to become a free agent after 2026, and he's expected to command upwards of $400 million. The smaller market Tigers simply cannot afford to prevail in a bidding war against the Dodgers or Yankees.
So the system forces small market teams to trade generational talent.
Exactly. And this situation perfectly demonstrates why MLB is bracing for a potential work stoppage when the current labor agreement expires next year. Owners outside of big markets will argue fiercely for financial reform.
On the college front, immediate turmoil at Michigan football.
Coach Sherrone Moore has been abruptly fired just 2 years into his tenure. A university investigation found credible evidence that he engaged in an inappropriate relationship with a staff member. And the timing is disastrous, as it's right in the middle of the crucial transfer window.
Finally, we end with two wonderful human interest stories. The first, a small town solving its financial crisis with surprising ingenuity.
This story comes out of Lakeview, Oregon. The small town was in a serious fiscal bind and couldn't afford to clear the snow from the streets last winter. Their solution was brilliantly simple and required immense community spirit.
They stripped for snowplows.
That's the short version. Residents, a mix of middle-aged and elderly men and women, one featured on the cover, is 77 minutes, volunteered to pose nude for a charity calendar called Outback Naked.
That's a fantastic example of necessity driving creativity.
They've netted about $13,000 so far. The coordinator noted the spirit of the project. If you take your clothes off, your face looks different. It's an extraordinary example of community bonding.
Our final story brings us to Atlanta's airport, highlighting the value of personalized, genuine human connection in the brutal corporate travel grind.
This is the story of Yvonne Carvalho, a gregarious bartender in the Delta Sky Club at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport. She has become legendary among frequent business travelers.
Her core appeal is that she remembers the details that make people feel seen.
Exactly. She remembers names, complex drink orders, even personal details about their families or their jobs. She greets regulars with a hug. For travelers who spend their lives shuttling between cities, walking into her Sky Club is often described as like coming home.
It just underlines a simple truth.
That even in a highly digitized corporate world focused on efficiency, personalized human connection creates immense loyalty and makes people feel at home.
What a fantastic contrast to end on. We've covered everything from the deep financial risks being taken on Wall Street to finance the M&A boom to the fiercely contested decisions that will drive Fed policy for years to come.
And we've seen the sheer audacity of Ukraine's Operation Spiderweb, the high-stakes chess match between the U.S. and Europe over reconstruction funding, and the political friction reshaping media and banking here at home.
But what stands out to me is that tension between the highest tech ambitions and the most basic human necessities. You have Musk and Bezos racing to put AI data centers into orbit to solve earthly power problems.
And yet, on the ground, you have small towns in Oregon solving the problem of snow removal, the absolute necessity of safe community life, by posing nude for calendars. We have the SBU using smuggled drones because traditional methods failed.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
It suggests that while the technological frontier moves toward the stars, reliance on raw, sometimes desperate, human ingenuity and necessity remains the constant force driving our world. Whether it's designing a customized Trojan horse for a drone attack or just daring to bear all for a snowplow.
The sophistication of technology only highlights the unchanging nature of human daring.
And the eternal battle against necessity.
A great and provocative thought to end on. Thank you for guiding us through this extensive deep dive into the Wall Street Journal.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. We hope you feel thoroughly well-informed and ready to tackle the week ahead. We'll talk to you next time.